Members of the chair will call the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. There is a quorum, and Representative Mueller, if you would be so kind to move the minutes of March 13th, and I believe there's an oral amendment to those minutes.
There is, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move the minutes for March 13, 2009 with an amendment that House File 1421 was heard on an informational basis.
Very well. Discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and our March 13th minutes as amended are adopted. Members, we have three bills up today, and before we get started, I know not all the committee members are here, but I do want to just acknowledge the fact that most of us were here till pretty late last night. We went right up against the midnight hour. That's a real testament to your commitment to the work before us. But, you know, quite frankly, it was the work itself that was really humbling for me. We heard some really tough testimony. I know we have some members, particularly those who have worked in law enforcement and who prosecute cases and community activists, who are probably more used in the chairs to, unfortunately, hearing some of the tales that we heard last night. It was a pretty emotionally draining evening, and I just want to acknowledge all of you for engaging with the public in a very respectful, engaging, and supportive way for the folks who were with us. We had a number of high-quality bills from both sides of the aisle, and there's never enough hours to, frankly, talk through them as fully as we want to, but I thought the quality of our conversation was good. It was honest. Very responsible. So thank you, members. It's my privilege to be your chair in this committee. So members, we have three bills before us. They're really focused on, I would argue these are really focused on our expectations of excellence for our police officers. And so we're going to start off with Representative Lesch. So, Chair Lesch, House File 1236. Okay. And Chair Lesch, I believe your motion is that House File 1236 be laid over for possible inclusion.
That sounds like my motion, Mr. Chair.
Sounds good. House File 1236 is before us. My understanding, Chair Lesch, is that this bill made its way through your committee as well, Judiciary?
That sounds correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Very well. So, Chair Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill regulates the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, commonly referred to, albeit incorrectly, as drones by, well, law enforcement doesn't refer to them that way, but whatever. They're UAVs. More importantly, it establishes a search warrant requirement for drone use unless an exception applies. This is subdivision two. The exception to the warrant requirement include, and I want you to pay close attention to these exceptions to the warrant requirement, members, because I expect, although they'll be able to tailor their testimony in the alternative after hearing this, but I expect most of the objections to the bill are already covered in the exceptions that are included to the warrant requirement here. So this includes in an emergency area that involves a threat to life or safety, in a public area if law enforcement obtains a court order based on reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, to counter the high risk of a terrorist attack, and in situations of man-made or natural disasters. Now, if a drone is used under one of these exceptions, law enforcement just must submit a statement to the district court within 48 hours. So we're tracking the use of non-police personnel, that being technology, that is used to surveil on innocent civilians. And that is important, members, because as we all know, we are innocent until proven guilty. And we've consistently run into situations at the legislature where data is being collected on innocent individuals in order to justify something that could happen later on. I remember in this debate that came up on, I think it was license plate readers, yeah. I asked the Minneapolis police chief, why she needed to know what I've been doing, what I'd be doing for the next 60 days, when I haven't done anything wrong. And her answer was, Well, because we don't know that you might do something wrong. We just need to track you for that reason, which was revealing. Nobody prepped her on that. She probably would have answered differently if she was prepped. But the bill also includes several limitations on use, including they have to comply with FAA requirements and guidelines, which already exists. The FAA thinks they own everything 50 feet above our heads, which is a little ludicrous, but it is what it is. Acquisition of drones must be approved by the governmental entity overseeing the agency, unless, so you can't just, you know, a rogue cop can't just go out and buy one and say, hey, I'm going to surveil using this. It has to be approved. This includes a policy, too, doesn't it? Do they have the policy? Doesn't it? Well, we want a policy anyway, but it's not in the bill. The agency may not deploy facial recognition or other biometric technology unless authorized by a court order or warrant, and it may not be equipped with weapons. The bill classifies drone footage as criminal investigative data and mandates deletion of data collected on a person or place that's not subject to the warrant within 24 hours. The subject of drone surveillance will eventually receive a notice similar to tracking warrants that we have passed, members, and there are reporting requirements on law enforcement and court administration. That is the bill. Members, the reason that this bill is up is it's the latest in a long panoply of efforts by the legislature to control the unfettered and Wild West use of technology, which implicates your civil rights. Because of the way Minnesota law is structured, unless you have a law in place, it can be used, and there's no oversight. Second, the data collected from these technological implements, including drones, is public, unless it is investigative data, or this legislature has created a data set. Okay, so that means the unintended consequences of all this surveillance is that your neighbor can go in and check out video of you flown by a police drone over your house to find out what you've been doing. That, we don't want it. The law enforcement doesn't want that either. No one wants that. But because of the way the Minnesota Data Practices Act is structured, that is a very real danger that we have in not having any regulation on that. So with that, I have with me Mr. Ben Feist of the ACLU of Minnesota, who can speak to other aspects of the bill.
Very well. Thank you, Chair Lesh. Mr. Feist, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ben Feist, Legislative Director with the ACLU of Minnesota. We're here in strong support of this bill, as we have been since 2014. This has been a long-term effort. As it was first introduced back in 2014, it was a much different bill. It was sweeping and didn't have as many exceptions, brought in a lot of other governmental entities other than law enforcement, and over the years it's been significantly narrowed to the bill that we have before us today. A lot of that has to do with taking law enforcement concerns into account. There was a similar bill that Representative Johnson had also introduced on this topic where some of the language actually comes from his bill. And it's now in a place where I think it's really time to move forward and get ahead of this issue of law enforcement drone use before every department has them. Now, I believe we're probably going to hear from some law enforcement departments today that are currently using drones. We hope that they're doing this the right way, but there is no statewide law regulating their use right now. So we do think this is really important, mostly, as Representative Lesh said, because drones have the potential to turn on its head that American principle that we don't watch innocent people just in case they do something wrong. If these are unregulated, they can interfere with Minnesotans' reasonable expectation of privacy, chill First Amendment protected activities, and lead to discriminatory targeting. And we've certainly seen that with other types of technologies. So, again, the bill is meant to really go after secret surreptitious surveillance. And we recognize that there are a lot of positive law enforcement functions of drones, and that's really covered in these exceptions. The one area that we are still working with law enforcement, and I was having conversations with Mr. Evans from the BCA just yesterday about ways that we might still be able to tweak the language about how drones should be used in a public space to do generalized surveillance. We don't have complete agreement on that piece yet, but we are working on it, and there's a willingness on my part to fix that language to address law enforcement's concerns. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very well. We do have some questions. We also have some folks who are going to testify on the bill, I believe, with concerns as well, and we'll open it up as well to members of the public that want to support the bill. But we do have some immediate questions generated. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, the last time this bill was up, I believe it was in Chair Lesh's committee in Judiciary, there was a concern raised about using drones by law enforcement over a traffic accident and helping to kind of understand what happened at the accident. Has that been addressed?
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, that should be in the exceptions already. We have very clear language about any time. 3A. Yeah, 3A deals with any emergency situation that involves a reasonably likely threat to the life or safety of a person. So in those cases, law enforcement would not have to go to the extent of getting a warrant. They could immediately put the drone in use.
I'm sorry, what was the site in the bill again?
This would be on line, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, line 1.15, subdivision 3A.
Got it. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I did read that. I guess I read it differently, and that would be my concern. Like an immediate threat, like as in a child's missing and they need to, you know, go over a cornfield to find the child. But this, I'm thinking more like in reconstruction of an accident where it's not exactly an immediate threat or an emergency. It's more of their use for recreation of something. And I can't imagine that should be prohibited. So I think that's what they were getting at more so, and I just don't read the language to cover that.
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I would be very open to adding some language about in the aftermath of an incident or something like to that extent. But I didn't hear anything specific from law enforcement about what they would like. So as I continue to have those conversations, as I'm sure I will as this moves forward, I will take that into account and we'll try to fix that.
Just closing. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I know that was something they were specifically concerned about, and even my own sheriff let me know that that was something they were concerned about in Wright County, that they wanted to make sure they could use drones to, because it's a lot cheaper, like they said in the testimony, than flying a helicopter over and trying to take pictures or video or something of the scene if it was a pretty bad one. So thank you for working with that.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author or testifier, just some questions that I have that have come up. So similar to Representative O'Neill, I live in a county that's pretty big, and I'm just wondering, we get a lot of grass fires or we have a lot of wilderness areas. Is that covered in the exception? Because I just wanted to make sure that that is, because in talking to my local sheriff, that's something that they would want to make sure that I knew before I voted on this bill, one way or another. So like a grass fire or a child who is on, maybe a special needs kid that has gotten out of the home, could be walking through an area that is very wide and, the use of a UAV is far cheaper than a helicopter. Just want to make sure that that's covered in the exception.
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I believe that your first example of the fire would fall under subdivision 3D at line 2.20, which deals with operation to prevent the loss of life and property in a natural or man-made disaster or to deal with recovery.
And Mr. Chair.
So nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, on your line 1.9, it says law enforcement agency. Does that cover, and this might be a question for legal, but does that cover the fire department that would maybe also want to use a drone to combat a grass fire to get a better perspective on how to best fight that?
Ms. Chair.
Chairman Lesh.
And Representative Nash. I don't know, but I wouldn't be adverse to putting that in. I think it'd be fine to have that in there.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you. And Chair Lesh, I just want to make sure that we don't set up gotcha moments for firefighters who might have to go and address, because grass fires are nasty. I don't know if you've ever been out in the county when a grass fire is going on. It's an all hands on deck, and a UAV might be a very handy tool to be able to deploy. And if this creates ambiguity, it may preclude them from using that. I did have some other questions, Mr. Chair.
Please, Representative Ash.
So I guess the other question I would have is, does this policy mirror the use of helicopters? Is that something? Because helicopters, if they're in the air, they just get deployed and they get to begin doing their thing. So could this then create a stumbling block for perhaps a law enforcement agency that would like to use UAVs to track somebody who might have been pursued in a vehicle and now they're on foot? Is that all wrapped up in the exception? Or because I'm not clear on that.
Chairman Lush.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, yes, I maintain that is that's provided for in 3A. Now, I would say that the point of this, if someone had suggested, what's the difference? I mean, we don't have any restrictions on going up in a chopper and tracking down the bad guys. Why would we do it on drones? We maintain absolutely there's a huge difference. This is a resource question in order to protect your liberties, quite frankly. If it's important enough for an agency to expend the resources to put up a helicopter to track someone down, I feel pretty confident that they have a pretty darn good reason to do it. The problem is that when you have surveillance being done so cheaply and in such a limited way, I'm not going to say anything.
That is a bit of a distraction.
That's when we want to have the reasonable restrictions on it to make sure that, no, it is as much of a priority so that if they got to do it, if it's in one of the exceptions, then they're good. But we specifically drafted it so that it didn't address helicopters. You still want to put up a helicopter, pay for that to do it, hey, knock yourself out.
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to try to not look at Representative Lucero. It's hypnotic.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad that everybody's noticing my pie for Pi Day today, yeah. 3.14.
Happy Pi Day, everyone.
Okay, back to you, Jim. Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, this is an odd example, but there is a municipality that is not in my district but directly adjacent to it that has banned the use of UAVs over their airspace, period. How does this all get sorted out? So if that would be the Hennepin County Sheriff, the Hennepin County Sheriff were to get a warrant to follow somebody or to utilize a UAV, and then they bump into, it's St. Bonifacius that has banned the use of UAVs. It's in their city ordinance. So how does that work? Because As Chair Lesh will know, I'm always an inquisitive guy. I want to know a lot of details before I vote on something.
Well, if
how
I could
work, Lesh? How if does I get all sorted out,
Mr. Chair? I'd have one question for you first, Representative Nash. Is this a civil ordinance, and is there a civil penalty for violating this airspace, or do they create a criminal law?
Representative Lesh, I do believe it's a criminal penalty. I can get back to you on that, but. I think that this is good, and you know that I have a lot of the same concerns you do on data privacy. I think that this is something that is something we want to address, but I also understand the utility of UAV from a cost perspective and from a flexibility perspective for law enforcement, particularly for somebody who, like myself, lives in a county that the sheriff may have to deploy something quickly. And maybe we can talk offline, but I do have a lot of questions, but I think that one specifically would want to be addressed because, a city that went down the road of actually creating ordinance that bans the utilization of these, it might want to be something that you want to tuck into the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, what we have is a little bit of a conflict of laws issue. So law enforcement absolutely has the right to pursue suspects or evidence across jurisdictional lines, even if it went across the county line into St. Bonifacius. Now, if the St. Bonifacius city attorney wanted to find out if they could associate an operator with that drone that was flying overhead and still wanted to go ahead and pursue some kind of criminal charges on that, I'm sure the judge in that, you know, St. Bonifacius, is that in Carver County or Scott County?
St. Bonifacius, Mr. Chair. St. Bonifacius is Hennepin, and my district is all Carver.
Okay, so that judge, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash, the judge in Hennepin County
would have to decide which flavor of law they would be applying in that. And I'm assuming that the prosecutor in St. Bonifacius would fail miserably in that. But it's a conflict of laws issue.
And Mr. Chair, and I never know because, you know, us country folk, we're scrappy. So you never know what would happen with that. But, you know, generally I'm supportive of things because I am very interested in data privacy. But if moving forward, some of those things that I brought up could be addressed in greater detail, I think that's going to provide particularly a lot of the sheriffs a lot of comfort. Because, again, if you get out into some of the northern Minnesota counties where it's a long way, and you may not be able to get people into a slough or a swamp or a large area of forest, but a UAV could be deployed quickly. I just think that there's got to be some questions that are still answered before that moves forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash, I mean, those are fair points to bring up, and we'll see if we can work on those.
Very well. Members, we have two other members with questions. I want to make sure that we get testimony from some of our law enforcement folks who have gathered here today, as well as others. So let's take these two questions, and then we'll move to opening up the testimony to that group. Oh, is it just one? Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I noticed that the bill bans putting weapons on it. Are you aware of any jurisdiction anywhere that is doing so?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Feist can speak to the jurisdiction. I know that I've flown drones, UAVs, with weapons in the military. I mean, pretty substantial weapons, Hellfire missiles, in fact, which make a big boom. But and we know that local law enforcement borrows a lot of what they end up using as law enforcement tools from initial military development. So that's part of the reason for this, but let me be clear. I don't think any police department in Minnesota is going to be using Hellfire missiles. Okay. Although they do, I think we got someone here from St. Cloud, Mr. Chair. It might be St. Cloud, it might not be, who had the 40-millimeter grenade launcher or something that they got a few years ago, which was in the newspaper. Maybe he can speak to that when he comes up. But Mr. Feist.
Mr. Feist, very quickly, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I'm not aware of a specific police department that is currently doing this. I do know, though, that nationally there has been a lot of debate around this issue, especially when we're talking about different types of weapons. Maybe that don't go that far. But would still be perhaps tasers and other pieces coming on. So the discussion is there. We're worried about it going too far, obviously. So that's why that piece is in the bill.
Just nip it in the bud, so to speak.
Chairman Considine.
Oh, sorry, Chairman Brennan. Yeah, just to nip it in the bud, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, and then we're going to you stepped out for a second. I was just signaling that I want to get the law enforcement testimony in as quickly as I can. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Chair Lesh, I appreciate what you're doing here. The one question I have is the issue that the testifier brought up, issue with law enforcement and over publicly owned property. The key word there is publicly owned. I know when I was on Drug Task Force, we flew a lot over publicly owned property with aircraft, and it took a lot of time and it took a lot of funds to do that, looking for marijuana grows and other activity that we had heard going on in the on state or county property. In fact, we even found a meth lab out there because we were able to use the aircraft, where a drone or a UAV would be much cheaper to do, save a lot of money, and be able to use those resources in other area. Plus, the fact that it is public property, I don't see why they wouldn't be able to even just check that area now and then for grow operations. We have a new type of labs being made that are very dangerous that we heard the bill on yesterday. To find those things, get them out of there so when the public is on their public property, they're safe. So I'm hoping you get that issue worked out because, like I say, it is public property and free for everybody to use, and we do need to make sure that it's safe.
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, like I said before, we are working with law enforcement on that. We'll continue those discussions. I will say that under the way the bill is currently set up, you would be able to use a drone in those circumstances if you have reasonable suspicion. So it's not the full probable cause. We do have that exception in there already with an understanding that if you can show reasonable suspicion that there's some kind of grow operation, that may be one way to do it. But we know that so far that has not been fully acceptable with the law enforcement folks, so we are looking at it. I'll also just mention briefly that the issue that we're really trying to get at in public places is the secret surveillance potential of this technology. So unlike some of the other technologies that have come before, including a helicopter, the idea that you might be able to put up a drone in front of the ACLU of Minnesota's office, because that's a public place, and just surveil with facial recognition technology and all this stuff, everybody who's coming and going, whether I'm at the office or not, who I'm meeting with, do we have clients coming in, really raises a lot of privacy concerns because of how this can be secret technology.
Mr. Feist, I'm just very curious, so how does that distinguish from public or cameras that are currently in public space? Because obviously there could be one located right on your block with the ACLU. Help us very quickly in terms of why it's important to make a distinction, if there is one.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think there definitely is a distinction there. The cameras that are on the street corners are capturing surveillance footage. They're also there very publicly, and they're probably trying to deter certain types of conduct. They have giant stickers usually saying law enforcement is watching you. This is drone technology is the opposite. For us, this is about being able to do this in a secret way from very far away. The technology is advancing to the point where with some of the more high-powered drones, you could be blocks and blocks away and still be able to use facial recognition and see everybody who's coming and going through that entire neighborhood. So widening the surveillance net in that way and doing it in a secret way that nobody has any reason to believe they're being watched is the fundamental difference from our perspective.
Thank you. That's helpful to me. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, we weren't talking about going down neighborhoods. We're talking about large forest areas. Law enforcement already has the ability to walk anywhere they want on that property. But to be able to search or just look to make sure that there's no safety concerns for the public, I think your stance on that might be out of line.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can speak to that. Members, this is the entire point of this bill, okay? Law enforcement can already do all of these things. An individual officer can already do all of these things without a warrant, without any restrictions, without any exceptions required. And if they want to do that, let them. Let them do it. Because the protection of our liberties means that the resources which government uses to surveil us is limited by a public decision about that. One of those public decisions is how much we fund law enforcement. So if we want to have one cop for every five people in the state who can check out everything, walk every square inch of public land to make sure everything's safe, we can make that decision and we can fund it. But the potentially nefarious aspect of these drones is that surveillance can take place outside of the review of bodies like this, whose ultimately the job it is to decide where the line is between our liberty and our safety. And that's why we're putting this in place, because now we know you can do that for much cheaper. You can fire cops and bring on drones if you want to do that too. So that. And it's also the demarcation described, Mr. Chair, between having a camera on a lamppost in a neighborhood and having a drone that can move anywhere and surveil anything you want at any given point. There's also a huge demarcation, as much demarcation between that as there is between the camera on the post and an individual officer who can do anything. So I just wanted to say that for the record.
Very well. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take testimony from some folks from law enforcement. who have come to express their views and I believe their concerns. We'll do some questions. I really want us to move hopefully in about 10, 12 minutes because we do have two other bills. We have our neighbors from Prairie Island who have come up for one of our bills. I know Representative Dean is pressed with another bill elsewhere. So with that, I'm going to ask, actually I don't have the names, but I know there are some folks in law enforcement that have traveled to come and testify on this bill. If you can come forward, please. Good afternoon. Good to see you again. Welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for having me again. I'm Tim Leslie, Dakota County Sheriff. I was here last week. Representative Dean's House File 377 testified on that. Thank you for listening to me again. So, yes, I'll be in opposition to this legislation, and I'll state my reasons. Events usually drive policy, and I'm at least in Dakota County, surveillance by our UAV drones are banned. We do not surveil. It's in policy, and so we do not do that. So that's I'll make that initial statement. Not being familiar and operating drones myself, I asked my chief pilot to help me understand how regulated this is. And so I will read a statement from my chief pilot who operates the drone program in the Dakota County Sheriff's Office.
Very well.
So it sounds to me we're already regulated. We are issued a certificate of authorization from the FAA to operate our drones. We document our flights and also file a notice to airmen for every flight. We maintain and register the drone within federal airworthiness guidelines. All airspace is federally controlled. We fly in Class G airspace up to 400 feet and sometimes Class E airspace up to 400 feet. I believe the privacy standard is established by Katz versus U.S. in 1967, where the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. Specifically, there are two prongs. The individual must have an actual expectation of privacy, and society must consider the expectation of privacy to be reasonable. California versus Serralo in 1986 established that officers flying over a person's house and seeing a marijuana growing operation in their yard is not a search. The court reasoned that anyone flying over his yard could have seen the plants. This continues with Dow Chemical versus U.S. in 1986. It involved the EPA photographing the Dow Chemical plant using a commercial mapping camera. The court found a search had not been conducted, even though the photograph showed more detail than a human could see. Lastly, U.S. versus Cusimano established using a FLIR camera to search for a heat source within a residence or structure is a search where a search warrant would be needed. In this case, the court and the people have an expectation of privacy in their home. Thus, we would need a search warrant for that. Although we do have FLIR cameras on our drones, we would apply for a search warrant if we ever were looking into someone's home. Our policy prohibits surveillance, targeting a person based on race, gender, or discrimination or harassment. In terms of Section 3, line 1.15, in response to that, we already maintain a record documenting the flight. It's available according to our records retention policy. We are using the drone for public safety and search and rescue operations, crime scene searches, and crash and disaster documentation. Then I would skip to the end in my closing under that last section. A search warrant requirement for a drone use is not applicable for our operations. The Supreme Court and other state courts have already determined the privacy issues surrounding those. We already comply with all federal and state standards regarding our drone use. The bill would create additional staff work for judges, law enforcement, courts, and the state, because I believe we already are heavily regulated. We care for the public trust. We manage it like a fragile flower. We're not going to screw this up. Our ability to use drones for public safety is critical to our efficiency of how we operate our business. And that means going after children who are lost in the woods. That means monitoring our flood systems that we're doing right now in terms of our dam at Bilsby in Dakota County, to making sure that the water's not overflowing those or putting it in a critical state where it could flood the city of Cannon Falls. So treasure this opportunity to use drones, and we will make sure that we will do it in the best regard for public safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. And we also have another testifier. Please, sir, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Sergeant David Tim with the Baxter Police Department. I'm representing our group. We have a Crow Wing County UAV team of approximately 14 pilots, and we were funded by a regional grant, so we serve a five-county area. And, you know, we're a rural area. I also represent a large networking group of public safety drone pilots, or UAV pilots, of approximately 125 members, representing all four corners of the state, rural, metro. And it's a great way for us to network and share and hear from a lot of different input, thanks to the power of the internet. Representative Lash mentioned testimony that you would likely hear from us regarding exceptions. And one exception that I have not read anywhere is training. Everyone in this room would probably have an expectation that our pilots would be safe, effective, and efficient at what we're doing. And unfortunately, we can't do any of those things without training. In a recent training exercise, we were able to deliver a personal flotation device within inches of a distressed swimmer. We had a large water exercise involving North Ambulance Aviation, water patrol units from multiple fire and sheriff's office jurisdictions, ground personnel. It was a very large event, including our UAV team. And it took a lot of training up to that point of delivering personal flotation devices to get to the point where we were able to deliver that within inches. It was pretty amazing, considering where we started. But we couldn't do that without training and without practice. And I'm not seeing any exemptions for that. I've looked at different laws from many other states. Utah, Virginia, North Dakota, just to name a few, all offer a specific exemption for training or training scenarios. The other concern that we have, we've talked about crash reconstruction. And a lot of times with crash reconstruction, we have, you know, two major highways in our area, 210 and 371, and they've both been the focus of safety projects because of our high number of serious injury or fatal crashes in recent history. We're using our UAVs to document these scenes, not only for the purpose to assist State Patrol with crash reconstruction, but a very vital resource has been to share this data with our traffic passenger safety coalitions. Not only are we taking aerial photographs, but we're flying our UAVs approximately 6 to 8 feet off of the ground and following the track or the path of the vehicles. This gives the committee, engineers, and other members a perspective of what the driver potentially saw prior to the crash. And this information, based on feedback we've received, has been vital as far as looking at signage, how the driver could have been confused, how the driver may have had their view obstructed, to get a better understanding of what was going on the moments leading up to these crashes, truly in an effort to try to make things safer. Now, we could argue that that's protected under the public safety exception. However, we didn't get a warrant for that, and the data retention might require us to delete that within 24 hours, and we unfortunately can't meet as a committee within 24 hours. Training, data retention, and also public safety flights, non-criminal. So something that I couldn't necessarily apply a warrant or a court order because it doesn't have a criminal focus, such as large events, such as our 4th of July event in Brainerd, the ice fishing extravaganza, which if you're not familiar with, literally thousands and thousands of people get on a lake with thousands of holes. Seems like a disaster waiting to happen, but thankfully nothing has. But we might use our UAVs there just as a resource to help observe from afar in case something were to happen to direct resources, direct emergency personnel, keep an eye on things. Additionally, like has been talked about in previous hearing as well as this one, is for storm assessments, damage assessments, being able to look back at that data, whether it be a week, 2 weeks, or whatever, to track things, again, with the 24-hour rule in here, might be prohibitive in the future to reflect on those data collected. Another resource that we use our UAV for is to take pictures of empty intersections. So usually what I'll do now is I'll fly in the early morning hours, take an aerial photograph of an empty intersection, save that photograph, and use it for a template for crash reports. This allows us to get a current image of that intersection, and then we can, on our diagram with the MinCrash system, place the vehicles or pedestrians or whatever objects might be in there with a current and relevant photo of that intersection rather than a poorly drawn sketch or a Google image or something like that. And again, I don't know if we'd be able to do that under this legislation because we would be retaining that image past 24 hours. I'd also be open to any questions on how we're using UAVs or any other input information I could provide. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sergeant Tim. So did you make the drive down from up north today?
I'd like to say I flew by drone, but I did drive, yes.
Well played, well played. We have another testifier. And members, we're about a minute or two away from the spot that I set for myself. Obviously, we're going to do this a little bit longer, but we are going to want to move relatively quickly. This bill is scheduled. The motion is to lay this over, which is going to allow us to have some further work happening among the author, law enforcement, and other community members, our ACLU and others. And so this certainly won't be the end of our vetting of this issue. But welcome, sir, to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Lieutenant Martin Sayer. I'm a 23-year veteran of St. Cloud Police Department, currently a patrol lieutenant and executive officer for our special response team. I administer our UAV program as well. We support UAV and special operations throughout the St. Cloud metropolitan area, responsible for public population of about 107,000, plus all the people that visit our community. I want to inform you today about the benefits of the UAV program to public safety, as well as why I oppose this moving forward. I find it's overly restrictive and burdensome for law enforcement agencies, and a lot of it doesn't really apply to our actual use of UAV devices. Primarily, where I want to focus, I agree with the sheriff in Dakota County. We also have, in some ways, more restrictive guidelines in our policy, but it's also very similar. We do not use this for that type of surveillance of individuals. And if we do, it's prohibited by policy unless we're doing it with a search warrant or a court order. Okay. On October 1st, 2016, the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas was the site of the deadliest mass shooting in American history. This incident forced us to rethink our risk assessment and mitigate risk as a result for those type of incidents that occur in the city of St. Cloud. We have a regular occurring festival of 10,000 plus every week during the summer, and it's my responsibility to do the risk management planning and risk mitigation on this. This proposed statute in its current form virtually eliminates law enforcement's capability of utilizing UAV for risk mitigation. Having a requirement by statute to be able to articulate a likely threat or to life or safety of a person absent credible specific intelligence cannot always be done. We have similar festivals, concerts, and gatherings throughout the year in our region. We feel this is going to restrict our ability to utilize this tool to protect the citizens that we have sworn to protect. We're open and transparent to our community. We receive resounding positive feedback from our community members about the use and why we use them. Our UAV pilots are also trained in safe operation, legal usage, and compliance with FAA regulations. Just looking over this bill altogether, it hampers or restricts law enforcement's ability to conduct search and rescue, specifically lost children, high-risk vulnerable adults, suicidal, mental health patients. We've had 89 deployments since we started our program. That would be 89 times I have to go before a judge for routine surveillance of a public area or routine observation of a public area and these types of calls. We can rapidly deploy from an active squad car within 2 minutes this resource to be able to find these types of people that we're looking for, lost children and vulnerable adults. Crime scene photography and processing that occurs in a public space. This alludes to not only your major car crashes, but your major incidents in a public space where we can do this type of photography. I can go on the rooftop and take a picture of that same intersection, but not face the amount of regulation I have here utilizing UAV. We also have concerns about utilizing this with the fire department. During the fire, I don't want firefighters focusing on operating UAV. I'd rather have our police officers assisting them, giving them information on hotspots inside that apartment building, that house, so that they're able to respond to the appropriate locations. Interiors of residents, as we have lawfully entered through consent, search warrant, or exigent circumstances. This is critical for us. We get search warrants. We do search warrants, high-risk search warrants, multiple with our SWAT team. I can add that exception to every single warrant so that we can utilize UAV. That's not a problem for me. As a matter of fact, I've already talked about things we changes we can make. But the problem is, if I don't get that exception, I can literally fly into a house now instead of putting a robot in it, instead of introducing a mirror, instead of introducing a pole camera. I can clear this areas visually without putting a human being in harm's way. Instead, I'm putting a $1,000 device in harm's way on a high-risk incident. My final portion of this is that UAVs give us the observational ability to view a public space where citizens know and understand that they do not have an expectation of privacy. Most of the public is happy to know that we are above our festivals, watching rooftops, watching areas. If their children is lost, we can quickly tell the operators their physical descriptions and they can look for them and locate them, and we have done this. UAVs give us, allow us at a greatly reduced financial burden to have the same capability of fixed wing and rotary aircraft. This enhances public safety for our community members while keeping costs minimal to the taxpayer. My proposal today is that the legislation be removed from consideration and rewritten with input from law enforcement stakeholders who have had operational knowledge and experience in unmanned aerial systems. The language of this proposed statute restricts law enforcement ability to protect the public that they serve and endangers the life of officers who serve with its current restrictions.
Very well, thank you, Lieutenant Saver, for your testimony. We have two questions on the list, and members, I do want to move on. quite frankly, it sounds like there's still some work that needs to be done. Mr. Feist did indicate that earlier, and so hopefully when this arises again, we'll have a conversation informed by those ongoing conversations. Those ongoing interactions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the officer from St. Cloud, referenced that the current legislation would hinder the ability for lost children, for fires, for high-risk situations you just mentioned. When I'm looking at line 1.15, which is subdivision 3, a law enforcement agency may operate the UAV and disclose information collected from the operation in an emergency situation that involves a reasonably likely threat to life or safety of a person. So I'm not sure that what you said was correct in terms of this would hinder
what
that,
section,
but if you
sir?
Could comment
I'm
on
sorry.
That.
I'm yeah, sorry. Ken, what section was that?
It's line 1.15 through line 1.17, first page.
Correct. Well, what I can tell you is what this says, the document, the factual basis for the emergency on a form created for that purpose by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Yes, we can submit that. We already collect data, what the flight was for, what we're doing. Where I have the issue is submitting a sworn statement with the district court setting forth the grounds for the emergency use not later than 48 hours after operation of the UAV. So you're asking the 89 times we deployed it, okay? If I can tell you that of that time, I'll give you a ballpark. Six had some success in exactly what we were trying to do. Okay, most of the risk mitigation that we've done has been successful, which I'm happy to say. But 89 times I have that officer that's already taking 2,000 to 2,500 calls for service a year. Now, trying to figure out how he's supposed to get in to make the sworn statement with the district court setting forth the grounds of the emergency and justifying it, where that same activity he could have done, it could be recorded on his squad video camera. It could be recorded on top of a building looking down with a simple camera. Our confusion is this is simply a camera. It just has a different platform in which it records, if you record, the activity. I can tell you that flying, I don't have a problem if you want it, you know, to fly this without recording anything at a major public event of 10,000 people. What's unreasonable with that is if we can't retain any of the data, we have that missing child, and that missing child turns out to be abducted, there's some pretty critical information we could have gathered in the course of that that would help us to issue that Amber Alert, to go to that next step. But our intention of flying it during these types of events has nothing to do with surveillance or invasion of privacy. It's all about public safety.
Very well. Representative Lucero, one more very quick, and then we have Representative...
Okay, well, I have several questions, but just to respond, so I'll just limit it to one more, but just to respond to that then. Okay, so as you initially mentioned, though, that this would be a hindrance to exigent circumstances, but then what I heard you just say is that your problem is more with having to articulate the use of within 48 hours after the use. So I just want to make it clear that it doesn't appear that this legislation as proposed would be a hindrance to an exigent circumstance. Then my question then, Mr. Chair, would be to the sheriff. You had referenced, since there's lack of time, I won't be able to do the several follow-ups, but so I'll just jump to my point is when I was in real estate school, Representative O'Driscoll was one of my teachers and taught that there was an area above the house that is considered private property. When I was in skills, we learned that, and I forget the case, maybe one of the attorneys could remind me, but there was a case about garbage cans being placed at the end of the driveway were subject to, or were considered then, to be able to be searched. But garbage cans still close to the house were not. And the sheriff then mentioned the example of flying over and being able to see, and there was a court case, I forget the distance, 400 feet or whatever it was, looking down to see something. And the sheriff also referenced looking into the house. So there was also a Supreme Court case that prohibited the use of infrared looking into a house. So given these examples, I would consider the use of a drone flying over somebody's backyard, potentially that might be fenced in with a 6-foot-high fence, would be more similar to the garbage can example than it would be to looking into somebody's house through infrared. And so that being the case, the more similar being the garbage can, I do have a concern with a drone, even if it exceeded the limit of what the court has determined is private property over somebody's residence, let's just say it's 400 feet, the drone may be flying at 410 feet, but has a camera to look down at the equivalent of flying 10 feet. And so I just throw that out there for this committee's consideration, is that there are some serious concerns with the use of these and the potential invasion to our liberties, as the bill author mentioned. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Representative Lucero. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it really short. In terms of this bill, in Edina, we actually have a drone. We have a certified flyer. Our municipality also uses drones. So with this, I see both sides, honestly, in terms of the public safety piece. I see a lot of benefit to being able to use it, and I know that it's been helpful. So I wonder, while you guys are compromising on this legislation, I think maybe a good compromise would be also just to make sure that I think it'd be great for the public to know about the reporting piece of it so that we can, is that open to the public, the reporting and documentation that you keep now?
Mr. Chair, members.
Sheriff Leslie.
Representative, in Dakota County, I have a Citizens Advisory Council made up of 16 representatives from across the county. They review all uses of the drone by Sheriff's Office personnel. So every 2 months when we get together, that's one of the first things on the agenda is the review of the drone use. Is it within policy or not? Every time it has been within policy. So I have a group that does that for me because they're the representatives that come out of the community to make sure that we are maintaining that public trust, that we're not violating surveillance methods. We're, you know, those are by policy a violation of our policy. You cannot surveil. So they make sure that we're not doing anything questionable.
Sheriff, would you be opposed to having that open to the public so that the public could see when the drones are being used?
Sheriff Leslie.
Mr. Chair, members. Absolutely. Come and you can read everything I have. I could bring it to you tomorrow if you want.
No, but it would be, thank you, Chair. It would be nice to be able to have, there's sometimes with reporting requirements, which I, you know, sure. To just briefly look at this, is to be able to, on an annual basis, that there's a report that's shown via each department how many times you've used the drone so that the public has access to it without having to contact you, because I think that creates a barrier between for information gathering for people that live in communities.
Sheriff Leslie.
Mr. Chair, members, so let's say like posted online somewhere in the sheriff's office website that you can look at all our drone uses, how we've used them, why we've used them, and whether they were in or out of policy and who reviewed them.
Is that okay with you?
That's okay by me.
Terrific. Members, I know there are other questions, but we simply are going to move forward. Chair Lesh, any final quick words here?
Mr. Chair, members, I would add two things. Members, be mindful of when we're talking about offering regulation and people come forward and say, please don't regulate us, we already do this the way you want. There shouldn't be an objection to that because we're simply wanting uniform standards. So if, in fact, the rules are being followed, policies in place with the way that we expect, there really should be no objection to this legislation whatsoever. Second, I think you've heard, just based on items highlighted by Representative Lucero, there's really a misunderstanding of what it does. Nearly every example cited by law enforcement right now is included an exception within the bill. Nearly every single one. You can still do that. The one exception is no. You can't just fly drones over a music festival outside and scope people out, zero in and see what they're doing. That's a little creepy. It just is. There might be some people that have a difference of opinion about that. They think that people think it makes them feel safer. It doesn't make me feel safer. It creeps me out. Or if you're out on a lake, there's a bunch of ice fishermen out on a lake, and there are holes out there, and so we want to fly it over a lake. And so we need to make sure what's going on. And members, I think this is fundamentally a philosophical debate about whether or not we think that's good or whether it's not. But I can tell you this right now. Police are here to help us feel safe. And that's their job. They're doing their job right now. But your job as legislators is to weigh that against people's individual liberty and expectations of privacy. So the objections you hear from law enforcement are to be expected because that's their job. And individual liberty, as you've heard from the testimony, really isn't as much in their wheelhouse as is making sure that everything is under their direct supervision and control in case something goes wrong. And I don't blame them for that. I honestly don't. They're doing their job. But it's your job as legislators to push back on that and make sure that citizens' individualized liberty is protected as well. I think the exceptions in this bill are more than adequate to do that, so I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh. The Chair lays House File 1236 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Have a safe drive back up to Baxter. Sergeant Tibbs. Representative Dean moves House File 2367 be laid over for possible admission of the omnibus bill. Representative Dean, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. House File 2376 addresses the issue of U visas. For those of you who don't know, federal law currently addresses the issue for foreign nationals that are victims of serious crimes, that they may be eligible to apply for a U visa. This bill is coming before you today because we have many jurisdictions that sort of process what a U visa certification does in very, very different ways in very, very different time periods. And what this does is it puts in place that the application should be processed within 90 days of the request for a U visa, and 14 days if that individual requests that it be processed in a quicker manner given deportation proceedings that may currently be underway. This is a public safety bill. This is not an immigrations bill. We already have laws regarding immigrations, and this is just trying to align the individual who is a foreign national who might be a victim of a serious crime in Hennepin County, the same standing as an individual who might be a victim of a crime in, say, Ramsey County. So it just puts in force some uniform standards that by a certain period of time the law enforcement agency will process and certify that individual. Again, this does not grant anybody permanent immigration status as a result of it. It puts them in a process that as long as they are cooperating with law enforcement, they can be in a temporary status that allows them to be here. The U visa only goes for a period of 4 years, after which 3 years an individual could apply for permanent residency status. And that's a requirement that they have to be here in the United States for 3 years. So I have a testifier here that I would like to turn over and talk about how critical this is in many given situations. It's Liz Richards. She is the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards, the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Testified in support of House File 2367, the U visa certification bill. As stated, the U visa is a United States non-immigrant visa for victims of domestic and sexual violence crimes who have been or are likely to be helpful to law enforcement in the investigation and prosecution of those crimes. The purpose of the U visa is twofold. The first is to be able to enhance law enforcement's ability to investigate and prosecute these crimes. And the second is to provide protection to the victims of these serious domestic and sexual violence crimes. One thing that is required when filing for or requesting a U visa is a certification from law enforcement that the victim is cooperating with and assisting law enforcement. The U visa certification is a sworn statement that says an individual is the victim of the crime, a qualifying crime, and has been, is being, or is likely to be helpful in investigating or prosecuting that crime. Any law enforcement officer with supervising authority can do a U visa certification. A victim cannot obtain a U visa unless they have a law enforcement certification. But having a law enforcement officer do a U visa certification does not mean a victim automatically qualifies for status. Rather, it is one piece of documentation that they need to submit in their application with a U visa. And ICE then makes the determinations about whether or not to grant the U visa itself. So, domestic and sexual violence victims have been having problems securing the U visa certifications. In 2015, this bill was being considered and it was introduced at that time, and we surveyed law enforcement agencies around the state to find out what was going on. And we found out that most agencies do not even keep records about whether their requests for U visa certifications or whether they're granting them. But we did find that those who did have some information on the requests, most were really reticent to sign the certification. And the reason most often cited was they lacked information on what this really was. There was a lot of confusion about what they were supposed to be doing, how this, what their role was, what it meant. We continue to hear from both domestic and sexual violence advocates working with immigrant victims that it is difficult to secure U visa certifications, and it certainly varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And it's difficult to get the U visa certification not because the victim fails to meet the qualifications, but because law enforcement agencies are unfamiliar with the process. We also are hearing about the extremely long wait times, sometimes up to 6 months, to get a request responded to, which creates all kinds of other problems for victims in this process. So this bill designates a certifying agent within each division. It provides a time frame for response and requires some publication about how the agency is actually processing these requests so victims know what to expect. The problems we're experiencing here in Minnesota are not unique. These are U visa certification problems happening all across the country. I know of at least 8 other states who have already passed similar legislation And I haven't actually done a recent scan, but I think there are at least three or four other states where it's currently pending. The value of the U visa is to protect immigrant victims of domestic and sexual violence. That purpose and the value of the U visa is undermined by this confusion around the U visa certification process at the local level. This bill provides clarity and a framework for law enforcement on the U visa certification, and I would urge you to pass the law.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Richards. You have any further testifiers representing?
Mr. Chair, this is my only testifier today.
Very well. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House File 2367? If not, I'll open this up for questions from the committee members. Representative Considine?
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Is there, when the local law enforcement decides to try to do this, is there any protection for the victim? I think most law enforcement has had problems sometimes getting ICE to cooperate with them, and where they have protect them for like 14 days until a certification goes through, or can ICE just sweep in, grab them, and remove them?
Mr. Chair, this is going way beyond my complete understanding. I know that for an individual that is currently within deportation proceedings, the time it changes from 90 days for certification to 14 days.
Mr. Chair.
If an ICE official decides to go ahead and deport them in that time period, can they do so?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't believe so that this would actually stop them from that, but I will turn it over to Ms. Richards to speak to it specifically.
Ms. Richards.
Chair Representative, well, I'm immigration law is not my expertise, but what I would say is that the reason why the 14-day on people who are already in the removal process is in there is because that's a time frame that should prohibit that from happening, partly. I suppose you could craft a scenario in which things are so far in the removal process that ICE could move at that speed to actually remove somebody. That's probably why the 14 days is there. And I think that that's a standard that's been used in other states who have passed this law. And I don't think they've been having those problems. But we could certainly look into it further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of my dealings with ICE when I worked for the sheriff's office, they'd come in and take somebody and just disappear when you tried to find out where they were. You couldn't.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just remind members that this isn't an immigration bill. It's really about a public safety bill and making sure that those victims have a sense of agency to go through a process in which they can cooperate with law enforcement and then at some point go through a process of actually applying for permanent residency at a later date.
Thank you, Representative Dean.
Representative Mueller, did you have a... Okay. Representative Paulson, then Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, can you just tell me what the definition of family member is on your bill here? Under the certification process, you have family member.
Mr. Chair and Representative Poston, immigration law is very clear on what family is. And if you look in immigration law, it would actually determine exactly what that is. So again, this is the certification process by the agency and then other pieces. I do know that when an individual may apply for their I-485 status permanent residency, there is a process in which other family members could apply at that same time. But that's, again, that's a national, I mean, that's a federal law. It's not related to this particular U visa certification that we're putting forward here today.
Ms. Richards, I'm looking the wrong way.
Chair Representative, under the U visa, the categories that are defined are spouse, child, parent. Those are the ones under the U visa specifically.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask the same question because normally we do a statutory reference because we have multiple different statutory definitions of what family means depending on where it's found. And so if you are referring to that reference in the federal law, then I would suggest that you do a statutory reference as to which family members or just explicitly say which family members because it is confusing. So there are several different definitions within Minnesota state statute, and then if you're referring to a federal statute, you should probably reference that, and that would be just in follow-up with
Representative Dean, it sounds like good advice. We're going to lay this over, and obviously we can continue to work on the language.
Mr. Chair, that would be my suggestion, that as we're laying this over, that we add that statute to make it crystal clear for folks.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Dean, I got a lot of questions on this bill, a lot of unanswered questions.
Representative Johnson, I do appreciate that, but I also want to get to our final bill.
Well, Chair Mariani, I had a lot of questions on the last bill, and you refused to call on me.
Representative Johnson, the last bill was laid over, as will this be, and so there's going to be more opportunity for us to be able to engage. The point is that we have testifiers from the public that have traveled here.
I understand that I had questions for the testifiers that were here.
We want to respect that they get their day in front of the committee. So, Representative Johnson, please go forward.
Chair Mariani, Representative Dean. On line 2.1, you talk about the certified entity process, the certification. Can you tell me what the certification paperwork looks like?
Mr. Chair, my testifier may have it. It's a documentation like any type of certification. I'm not going to say that it's, you know, just checking a box. It's a little bit more detailed than that. But it is a form that will actually be used as part of the actual U visa application.
Ms. Richards.
Chair, Representative, I have a copy of the form right here. It's a, I can certainly share it with you. It's a three-page form with various fill-in-the-boxes, check boxes, and then a couple of places for other short descriptive pieces.
Very
so
good.
I can certainly share that with you.
Okay, I'm just wondering if that's the was it 419 or I-419 or the I-48 or 14 or which one of the two forms?
I-918.
Okay, I appreciate that. And that's a form that has to be filled out by the person, not the agency, because it has to be actually signed and initialed by the person filling it by the applicant. And also, on line 2.5,
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, if I might, actually the last part 6, is actually where the certification takes place. You are correct that there are other parts of it that are part filled out by the actual applicant, but the certification is part 6, which has to be attested to by the agency.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Dean, on line 2.5, when you're filling this out, what's really interesting, this is supposed to be a crime victim who could be in the deportation process well down the pipe. And all of a sudden, let's say 3 days before the deportation hearing, claimed to be a victim of a crime that qualifies for this, they fill out the application. And is there a reason why that you have in there on between line 2.5 and 2.6 a active investigation are not required?
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I think an investigation may actually have gone through the whole process and be completed at that time. Active investigation, I'm not a prosecutor. I don't know all the particulars regarding that. It is a crime to report a crime that's not a crime. and this does nothing to change that. I think there's a misconception that victims of crime fabricate, you know, incidences in order to, you know, remain in our country. And, you know, the past few days we've talked a lot about victims of crimes, and I have not heard the same type of questioning for those individuals. So I think we really need to, you know, look at what the heart of this is, and it's really those individuals that are victims of crime. And in the end, law enforcement will be the individuals that are certifying this as well.
Ms. Richards.
Chair, Representative, the language on line 2.5 is, I think, specifically addressing a question that is often raised by law enforcement, that it doesn't have to be an active investigation. It could be a case that's already been closed that can qualify for certification. Because sometimes the question comes up from law enforcement, it's like, this is a crime that's already fully resolved. It's not because of the requirement around assisting or likely to or has assisted with prosecution. So there's been some confusion about that. This language is built into the law to be clear that it doesn't have to be an active investigation as long as you're certifying that it was a qualifying crime and there was cooperation either in the past or currently. So I think it's just to clarify that piece. That's what the language specifically is in the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, thank you for that clarification. Then I have another issue on subdivision 4, disclosure. These forms are, from what I could tell, checking, they appear to be, especially if they're in Minnesota, they're public information. In fact, on the form, there's a place if somebody doesn't want to find out where they live for public information, there's a place to mark for a safe location, so that information where their address is going to be is not disclosed. Minnesota, we are an open state unless we actually put in statute citing the chapter and all information that the state has is public information. I did do some checking where where this bill is going to be sitting, 111A.95, which goes into a section of law dealing with juvenile videotaping, I believe it's for sex crimes, for victims. And that's covered in Chapter 13. So I'm just wondering how you plan to keep this information private and non-disclosed without following one of the certain classifications in Chapter 13.
Chairman,
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I can't speak directly to where this language was enacted in a particular section. I would assume that our nonpartisan staff placed this where it was most appropriate. And I would just say that, you know, regarding non-disclosure, I believe that when it comes to victims of criminal activity, that there is some information that is not made public. And remember, this is related to federal law in the legal process at the federal level, as it says that the prohibition from disclosing the immigration status of a victim of criminal activity or representative requesting the certification, except to comply with federal law or legal process. So I think there is the exception for federal law in the legal process, and I would just respond with that.
The problem is that you have the agency that fills this house must keep a written or electronic record of all certification requests and responses. That is public information. Unless you get into Chapter 13 and it goes through the Civil Law Committee where they deal with those data sets, as far as I can see, it has to go to the Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the chair of the committee that deals with civil law is sitting at the table with us.
Chairman Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we're not creating a data set.
The language is a prohibition, and so the prerogative of, well, House rule does not mandate that it goes to civil law, and then because it's not creating a data set in this instance, since there's merely a general prohibition, I don't think civil law needs to see this.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Chair Lesh. It's keeping the information. It's required in the in this bill that the issuing agency keep a written and electronic record of all certification requests and responses. That's keeping the data. That is on line 2.12. So there is data that needs that the Civil Law Committee does need to look at.
So, can I ask your research, Mr. Chair? Are we designating a classification on this in this language, Mr. Johnson? Not Chair Johnson.
I think we're for.
Mr. Deeble.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, there is no designation in the proposed statute.
So, Mr. Chair, and I still, Mr. Chair and Chair Johnson, I still maintain no. We're not creating a data set. There's a general prohibition. It says you got to keep certain records, but I would say without the classification of the data set, it wouldn't too. I mean, if there's a huge, again, in keeping with the rubric of what goes to civil law, there's the rule, and then unless someone freaks out, you know, that's there too. I don't think we need to see it. If we, Ms. Chair, had to see this, I feel like it would open up a lot more other areas that would have to come. That we'd be there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, we're coming up on the closing of time, and I know there are individuals. I'd be happy to come back at another time to continue conversations around this bill, but for the sake of...
We're going to lay this bill over, Representative Dune, and so there will be another time for us to have it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, last word, and then we're going to move to lay this over.
The last word is, I've got a lot of concerns on this bill because there is data. It is public data that's being not classified, but just prohibited. Dissemination prohibited without a classification. That concerns me because then if we don't bring this to civil law, all this, we can make whatever we want without the Civil Law Committee or anybody else can hide things from the public without cause and without good vetting. So like I say, I have a lot of concerns about this, and I still believe if they're going to prohibit dissemination, it does, and it's the public, the government's holding data, Minnesota being an open state, it does need to go to civil law.
Final words.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, again, thank members for hearing this. Thanks for consideration of laying it over. If it's determined that this has to go to civil law. I mean, I'm not adverse to going to civil law, but, you know, I think that, you know, as I've been noticing the past few days, we can find things wrong throughout any bill we really want to and slow down the process that we have here. And we all know that tomorrow is the first deadline for policy committees. So it means that many of us have been here late nights. And we have, you know, another night tonight. And I believe that there is opportunity to continue to work on this as part of possible inclusion on the omnibus bill. And I just want to thank you for your time today.
Well, Representative Dean and Representative Johnson, it's actually a good conversation because we're talking about here what you raise as a specter of keeping the data of victims private. And it seems to me that's an important thing. Representative Dean, why is this a good bill, though, other than the fact that we've got this data issue?
Well, I would just say that this is a good bill, Mr. Chair and members, because, you know, one of the things we've talked a lot here is about issues around victims. And ultimately, I think the foreign national status citizens, I think we're all concerned about victims and victims of crime, and that, you know, they are put in a position where, one, they're in a safer place, but two, for law enforcement, this becomes a critical issue, because if people aren't willing to assist and participate because of fear of deportation, I think it creates some problems in our community regarding public safety. So that's why I believe this is important. That's why I'm carrying this bill.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Deamon. Thank you, Ms. Richards. The chair lays House File 2367 over for possible inclusion in the division's omnibus bill. Members, we're at the hour, but the next committee, there is no next committee here. I'm going to push forward for another 15 or 20 minutes. If we're not finished by then, we'll just come back in the evening. So with that, we have House File 719, Representative Kudish Padin. And I'm wondering, Representative Pinto, if you would be so kind to make a motion for Representative Kudish Padin. And the motion would be to lay over House File 719 for possible inclusion.
I am very glad to make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Kudish Padin, your bill is before the committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I am here this afternoon to present to you House File 719 on behalf of the Prairie Island Indian Community. House File 719 would remove the requirements that certain federally recognized tribes must have agreements in place with the local county sheriffs in order for the tribal police department to exercise the police powers on their reservations. I think it's really important to know that tribal police departments are very similar to the municipal police departments. Every officer is a board certified trained to the same standards as any municipal police officer and is subject to the same code of conduct, laws, and rules as any municipal police officer. The only real difference between the municipal police departments and the tribal police departments is that without an agreement in place with the local county sheriffs, a tribal police department cannot exercise its police powers on the reservation. And that's really what's important here to remember, is that without an agreement in place with the local county sheriff, a tribal police department cannot exercise its police power on the reservations. So in other words, they can't pull over anybody, they can't make any arrests, and they can't issue citations. So what this bill does, House File 719, it would allow the tribal police departments to continue to have cooperative agreements with other law enforcements, and most importantly, it would ensure that the tribal police officers are always allowed to enforce the law on their reservations. And so I would ask you to support this House File 719. It's an important bill for public safety, not only on the reservation, but off the reservation. And I would like to invite President Buck of the Prairie Island community to speak next.
Welcome to the committee, Madam President.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shelley Buck, and I'm the president of the Prairie Island Indian Community. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. The Prairie Island Indian Community is a Metawakaton Dakota tribe located along the banks of the Mississippi Rivers in Welch, Minnesota. We are a hardworking tribe with just under 1,100 tribal members, and despite the decades of broken promises and hardships, we are a strong self-governing sovereign nation, and we have a lot to be proud of. And one of those things that we're really proud of is our Prairie Island Police Department. We're here today to discuss why the Minnesota Statute 626.93 poses a serious concern for our ability to police ourselves and our land, which also goes to the heart of our self-governance. As some of you may know, the tribe's reservation is located 600 yards from the Prairie Island, from Xcel's Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant, which for those of you who are golfers are a long par five. And we are the closest community living next to a nuclear power plant anywhere in the country, whether it's tribal or non-tribal. So let me repeat that real quickly. We are the closest community living next to a nuclear power plant anywhere in the country. Additionally, over half of our land is in a floodplain that was caused by the construction of Lock and Dam 3 back in the 1930s. Our reservation is at risk for serious flooding every single spring. And unfortunately, the next 2 to 4 weeks is really concerning to us, and most of our time is being spent preparing for sandbagging. And I invite all of you to come join us either Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday to our sandbagging party to help us fill sandbags. You're all welcome. Lastly, we have an at-grade railroad crossing that goes over our one reliable road on and off the reservation that's blocked multiple times throughout the day by trains. And I know we're here to discuss the law and how it affects our police department, but I think it's really important that you all remember these key facts, because our police department is the first responders for any public safety issue at the power plant, any flooding that we're going to be dealing with here in the next couple weeks, and any train accident that could happen. I would like to introduce with me today are our Blake Johnson. He's our state government relations specialist and tribal member. Rayana Linus is our communications coordinator and tribal member. Our chief of police, John Preem, and our general counsel, Jesse Syme. And you will hear first from Chief Preem and then Ms. Syme. Adama Yayapi, thank you.
Thank you, President Bach. Welcome to the committee, Chief.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for allowing us this opportunity to speak before the committee. My name is John Preem. I am the Chief of Police for the Prairie Island Tribal Police Department. This is starting my 25th year working as a peace officer in the state of Minnesota. For the last 15 years, I've worked for Prairie Island. We are the official police department of the Prairie Island Indian Community, a sovereign tribal nation located in Goodhue County. I'm here today representing the Prairie Island Indian Community and asking for your support on this legislation that would modify the requirements for the Prairie Island Indian Community to exercise concurrent state law enforcement jurisdictional authority on tribal land. The proposed change to existing legislation is simple and straightforward. However, the intent behind the change is fundamental to recognizing the Prairie Island Indian Community for what it is, a sovereign tribal government with the power of self-determination. The current statute takes the tribe's authority to protect its people and assets and enforce the law out of its hands and leaves it up to the willingness of a relationship with an elected official. I'm not here to say anything bad about county sheriffs or any other law enforcement agencies. That's not really what this is about. In fact, the Prairie Island Indian Community enjoys strong cooperative relationships with several neighboring law enforcement agencies, and we plan to continue those partnerships. The proposed change is really about fairness and equity. Mr. Chairman, I believe you represent parts of the City of St. Paul. Imagine if the City of St. Paul was mandated to sign a cooperative agreement with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department as a condition of their existence. Imagine that Ramsey County decided to rescind that mandated agreement, essentially preventing the City of St. Paul from serving its citizens' public safety needs. Sounds kind of absurd. No local unit of government would operate that way, and none in Minnesota are required to, except the sovereign tribal nations covered under the existing law. In fact, of the 431 law enforcement agencies in Minnesota, 8 of which are considered non-municipal police departments, such as the U of M Police Department, Metro Transit, only 9 tribal law enforcement agencies are subject to this requirement. We've heard concerns that if this requirement were to change, the result would affect in such things as record management system problems or dispatching problems. Those issues are not directly related to a mandated requirement. I spent the first 10 years of my career as a police officer in a municipality in the western suburbs of Hennepin County. We experienced those issues with record management systems and disagreements with the counties and some of the cities neighboring. And we were one of the 321 municipal police departments in the state that are not subject to this requirement. We work those things out through cooperative agreements. I cannot speak to the intent of the original law, which I believe dates back to the early 1990s. There may have been a valid reason for the requirements. Most Minnesota tribal governments did not operate police forces in the 1990s. They did not have the financial resources to hire police officers or to buy law enforcement equipment. They relied solely on the county sheriffs and other local law enforcement. That is no longer the case, yet the language and the requirements of the law have not been updated to reflect that. For context, the Prairie Island Tribal Police Department was established in 2003. The police chief and the first two officers were hired in early 2004. Today, my department includes 14 licensed peace officers and one community service officer. Three of those officers are tribal members. Our officers are licensed by the State of Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, and this means that we're required to have the same training, education, and testing as any other licensed peace officer in Minnesota. My officers respond to more than 5,000 calls for service annually, and those calls run the full spectrum that peace officers face in every community in Minnesota. We're well equipped to handle emergency situations year-round on land and on water. In addition to handling service calls on Prairie Island, we respond as needed to support our neighboring law enforcement agencies and first responders in Red Wing, Goodhue, and Dakota County. I mentioned earlier that we have good working relationships with a number of law enforcement agencies. These cooperative relationships are the foundation of public safety, and they're built on mutual respect and trust, not on mandates. We have no intention of ending these agreements if the legislation passes, and we have no intention of withholding cooperation from our neighbors. When it is time for Rivertown Days in Hastings and the city is looking for a command vehicle and portable light towers to help manage their event, we'll be there to assist. When there's a bad accident on Highway 61 and the State Patrol or Goodhue County Sheriff's Department needs to close a road and divert traffic, they know that we have assets that can assist them. And in fact, this morning prior to coming to here, there was a serious accident at an intersection on Highway 61 and 316, and our officers were the first arriving agencies, beating both the county sheriff and the ambulance service. So we are a true asset to more than just Prairie Island, but to our community. When there's a fire in Red Wing or Meesville and first responders need support, we'll be ready to send the community's fire truck. Our partner agencies know that they can count on Prairie Island as a police department, and we can count on them. And I hope that we can count on you to do the right thing as well. The Prairie Island Indian community has the capabilities and resources to protect its community and enforce state laws on tribal lands. It's time to change the law and recognize and respect tribal nations for the mature, responsible governments that they are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Preem. Welcome
Chairman,
to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members. I'm Jesse Stomsky-Syme, and I'm General Counsel for the Prairie Island Indian community. And I realize that the time here is short, but I want to speak with you and start our conversation and really frame our conversation today around a concept that is so important to me as a tribal member and to all tribal members in all tribes, and that is tribal sovereignty. If we want to put a definition on that, we can call it the right of our people to determine our own destiny and governance and to what happens within the bounds of our territory. Now, our people had sovereignty before European contact, before states existed, before the United States existed. Yet today, we fight daily for it to be understood and respected. In 1953, the United States Congress enacted what is commonly known as PL-280, and it gave over full criminal jurisdiction to Minnesota and a few other states. It's important to understand the context in which this law came about. It was done during a time in federal policy called the Termination Era, which was a time where the government sought to get rid of the Indian problem by reducing tribal government, reducing their jurisdiction and reducing their funding, and hoping that Native people would simply assimilate, flow into mainstream America, and go away. But we're here to tell you, President Buck is here to tell you, I'm here with the members of Prairie Island to tell you that we've not gone away, and we grow stronger every day, as do our agencies, such as the Prairie Island Police Department. Now, in the 1990s, the state passed a series of laws, including the one that we hear about today, 62693. This set up a framework by which tribal police departments could enforce state law. As Chief Preem mentioned, tribal policing was just at its beginning, and it looks very different now. The statute requires a variety of things, including that the tribe agrees to be subject to liability just like any other agency, agrees to waive its sovereign immunity to all claims. It agrees to carry insurance and bonding for liability and lawsuits. We agree to comply with state data practices law. We also use Post Board certified officers, and we run things through the Post Board. Then it goes further to require the cooperative agreements with the county. Interestingly, though, the statute doesn't define at all what has to go into those agreements. What it does do, though, is it gives the counties the keys to the tribal police departments, their ability to turn on and off that operation that is responsible for our safety. Now, as Chief Prem alluded, let's look at who is required in this state to have those agreements with the county in order to police. Not the city police departments, not the non-municipal police departments. In fact, the U of M Morris, U of M Duluth, the Three Rivers Park District, the State Fair Police, Metro Airports, and Metro Transit, they don't have this requirement. It is only the tribal police departments. And I want to emphasize for you what this bill does, and equally important, what it does not do. It does not limit or reduce the jurisdiction of any state agency, including the counties. The county's ability to police does not change on the reservation due to what we are proposing. It does not extend or alter the tribe's jurisdiction or that of its police officers. It does not reduce the amount of current oversight by the county for the tribal police officers, because that is not outlined in the statute currently. And it does not direct any state law criminal proceedings to tribal court. All state law violations that the PIPD would cite for or arrest for, they all go to the county attorney, who has the authority to prosecute or not prosecute. So if I get arrested on Prairie Island by a Prairie Island police officer, I will be brought to a county jail and tried in a county court. What this bill does do is it recognizes that Prairie Island has concurrent jurisdictional authority to enforce state law, and it would make the cooperation agreement optional rather than mandatory. It would create a level playing field for negotiation of these operational agreements. It guarantees that the tribe will be able to regulate lawfulness within its own territory, and it eliminates the risk that we've seen from other issues around the state recently with other tribes and other counties is very real, that due to a political issue or long-standing problems, the county could unilaterally and potentially arbitrarily rescind the agreement and close the doors to our police departments, leaving a vacuum and a mess. Now, we've worked hard to gain consensus on this bill, and we've received wide support. But you'll hear today from the Sheriff's Association, Mr. Hutton, that who we thank for giving high praise to the Prairie Island Police Department yesterday when we were over at the Senate. We really appreciate that. But he mentioned, and he may mention today, that if the county agreement is not mandatory, then suddenly there, for non-members, there will be no representation and there will be no recourse. But that paints a false picture of what it is now and what it would be under our change. Today, non-members live and visit tribal land, and the tribe polices them. The statute requires the tribe to waive its sovereign immunity to claims, so a non-member would be able to pursue its claims just like any other agency. An individual can make a complaint to the police department, report to tribal council, or the post board. And again, all of the crimes are eventually handled by the county anyways, where a non-member would have representation in that system. I just want to wrap up here by circling back to where we started with sovereignty. Now, last month we had a wonderful day. All 11 tribes were here at the house with you, and I remember seeing or visiting with several of you, and thank you for that opportunity. It was a really wonderful and historical day. But this question was asked by a lawmaker: what can we do as state lawmakers now to right some of the historical wrongs that Native people and tribes have experienced? And it's what a great question, because I think most everyone in the House, in the Senate, in this room will say that they support tribal sovereignty, but how do you do it? How do you put it in action? And the answer is that when you have a decision to make, like you have a decision to make today or on this bill, when you do decide, take the opportunity to do something real to recognize tribal sovereignty and to support our self-determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Seem. Representative Kunesh-Pedin, does that complete your testifiers?
I believe so.
Very well.
Mr. Chair.
We do have a question, but what I want to do is move to further testifiers on the bill, and then we'll open up for questions. Good to see you again. Welcome to the committee. And you know that we're way past our adjournment time, and so I'll be asking you to keep your comments brief, and we'll be asking committee members the same. So please, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives. Thank you, too, Representative, for having a meeting before on the bill. And what Ms. Sein did not share with you earlier is she was one of my DARE students whom I taught there just a couple of years ago. I know, but I appreciate it. Obviously, things went well. All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Representatives. My name is Bill Hutton. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and three-term retired Washington County Sheriff. I am here representing the 87 County Sheriffs of Minnesota. I am also here in opposition to this file. The Minnesota Sheriffs feel that the current law of a cooperative agreement between the County Sheriff and tribal authorities is working well, but a few exceptions over the past 25-plus years. Without the agreement, the amendment makes no provision for a series of critical issues. Of significant concern is representation. I have a different perspective than Ms. Syme has on this. The proposed amendment does not allow citizens ultimate control over law enforcement through the election of the sheriff or other municipal authorities. Citizens would be subject to state law enforcement by a government in which those citizens cannot participate. City and county government is a creation of the legislature. Tribal government is not. There are reservations throughout the state where the majority of the citizens living there are not members of the tribe. These individuals can vote for their sheriff, mayor, or city council that ultimately appoints the police chief, but they cannot vote for tribal council members that will appoint their police chief. Meaning, if an individual calls for police service while on reservation land and they are not satisfied with the service they received, whom do they bring their concerns to? Yes, they can bring them to the police chief. Yes, they can bring them to the tribal council, but ultimately they have no avenue past that if they do not agree with the outcome. I have talked to numerous sheriffs that have cooperative agreements and are extremely pleased with their agreement, and they are very happy with the law enforcement that they have. They have great relationships with their tribal police, but they fear that any change to the language will jeopardize that relationship. The current statutory requirement of a law enforcement agreement works well and should be continued. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Hutton. Are there other testifiers? Welcome, sir, to the committee. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yep. I just came back up for questions.
Yeah, this is a holdover from last night, Chief Preem. thank you for coming back to the testimony table. We do have questions from Representative Johnson, Representative Considine, Representative Edelson.
Chair Mariani, testifiers, I got a few questions that I want to deal with. First of all, I had a party just text me about an ordinance down at Prairie Island, since the chief is here, and ask him about it. Prairie Island has an ordinance that's carrying a concealed firearm is against the ordinance down there. I'm just wondering how you compare that between state law, since you do concurrent. State law says you cannot do that. How would you handle that situation if you?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Normally what we do is we handle those on a case-by-case basis. There is an ordinance that restricts community members from carrying handguns on Prairie Island, and we take those things on a case-by-case basis. If it's in a public area of the reservation, then people are allowed to follow the state laws. If it's on the private property, for example, inside of a casino, then the casino has the ability to prohibit that.
So Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Chief, I'm reading your ordinance right now. I understand inside the casino you can ban them, but this is out in the open area. It says carrying a concealed, in a concealed matter, doesn't say the member of the tribe, it doesn't say the non-member, says no person shall carry on his or her person concealed in a concealed manner. Any firearm at any time within the community outside the person's own residence. That is in strict conflict with Minnesota state statute. Which would you rather, which are you going to enforce, the state statute or the city, tribal ordinance?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the ordinance on Prairie Island are civil ordinances. They're not criminal ordinances. So we would follow the state criminal law when it came to that.
And Chief Cream, who prosecutes the state criminal law in those instances? Then?
Mr. Chair, all of our criminal offenses are prosecuted through the Goodhue County Sheriff's Office. I'm sorry, the Goodhue County Attorney's Office.
County Attorney, very well. Sir Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I'm just wondering to myself which council member would be charged then for violating the state statute because they made an ordinance in, but I'm not going to answer that question. What I'm more concerned about is this bill. There's a specific reason why these mutual aid agreements went into effect. Now, you had talked about the 8 or 9 agencies that are not a city or a county or a state, or the state patrol that have police departments. You have the airport police, you have the U of M police, there's a couple other. But there's one thing different than the tribal nations. They're a government agency, a state government agency. And you've mentioned the single word sovereign nation numerous times. And it's great that you're a sovereign nation. I have no problem. I've worked the reservation in Mille Lacs. I've worked the reservation at Lake Lena, part of the Mille Lacs tribe band up there. And I've worked with the officers up there very well. We've got along very, very well. There's only two instances that I'm aware of that these agreements have ever been canceled or set aside because of disagreements. And the first time was in 2007 to 2008 when the Mille Lacs tribe canceled the agreement. And then again in 2016 through 2018, it was just settled here. Again, it was the Mille Lacs band. They eventually worked those issues out the first time. I can't remember what, 2007, what that was. This is the last time dealt with the area of the amount, basically the boundaries of the reservation. And that's right now it's in court for a lawsuit. And whatever happens is going to happen. But it dealt with a large amount of land in Mille Lacs County that would have been taken out of the tax rolls. It was a substantial area all around Mille Lacs Lake. But that's going to be tied up in court, and we'll let the courts decide that issue. But the one issue that this last time that it really came up how important these agreements are comes to the fact that you are a sovereign nation, and your land is a sovereign nation. With these agreements, if there's an issue, the state has some control over an officer situation or procedural situations. But without these agreements, the state has none of that. Without these agreements, I would be the first one to ban post-licensing the officers on those reservations. For the simple reason, without those agreements, the state has no authority on them. When that last time the mutual aid agreement was canceled, the sheriff from Mille Lacs County asked the state auditor to come in and do an audit of the evidence room before he took physical control of it to make sure everything was there and everything was right. All the I's were dotted, the T's were crossed, there was no missing evidence, everything was there. The response from the state auditor was, I cannot. I have no jurisdiction on the reservation because there's no mutual aid agreement. Without the mutual aid agreements, your police departments would be a privately run, non-state, with no authority for the state to do anything. That's why I cannot support this bill.
Representative Considine.
Goodness gracious. It's the sovereign nation. Is this a federal law that mandated the agreements? It's not a Minnesota law, is it? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, Public Law 280 is the federal law that delegated to the states criminal authority over Indian country. And then the state statute that we're talking about now is the one that lays out the requirements for a tribal police department in order to enforce state law.
Mr. Chair, damn, that's arrogant. You're on the one hand, we're acknowledging the sovereignty, but only as long as it is under our thumb. And I really think we should be going at just getting rid of the part where we have to have the agreements and then have the two sides on an equal footing can work on mutual agreements. Like I said, the word that just keeps coming back is arrogant. We have destroyed the treaties. We've made a mockery of the idea of sovereignty. I'm sorry, I'm just getting a little bit wound up about it, and I think I'm going to stop right now, but I think what we really should be doing is going after the state statute that says we have to have these in the first place and allow a sovereign nation to negotiate with the state of Minnesota on a mutually, on an even playing field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Feel free to expound.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to Representative Johnson? I want to make clear that the proposed change that we're making doesn't affect any of the elements that are currently in the statute. You'd mentioned concern that if this bill were to pass, we would be able to wall up and not provide any information to anyone. That is not true because a provision of this statute requires us to comply with all Data Practices Acts of Minnesota. So we're not trying to change that. We're not trying to change any of the other requirements, including the post-board requirements that we waive sovereign immunity, that we're subject to all claims. None of that is what we're proposing to change.
Well, Representative Edelson and Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Chair. I had the honor of visiting your community with Health and Human Services. I'm on the policy committee, and I want to thank you for having our committee out there. Mr. Huttner, you said that that you believe the agreement is working well. Is that correct?
Sheriff Huttner.
Mr. Chair, representatives in most areas, yes.
I am surprised to hear you say that. And actually, honestly, I'm a little angry because as a mom, when I visited the community, when I heard the stories of not having police for 1 year in that community, I don't know how you could possibly come before this committee and say that. And I'm a big supporter of the police. But when we have a community that essentially didn't have lawlessness for 1 year, kids were harmed. I mean, kids were not safe. Drug abuse went up significantly. I would like the Native community to actually speak to what happened in the community because I want to make sure this committee hears what happened during that 1 year. I see that you should be able to police your own community. So I would if somebody could just elaborate so the committee here understands the public safety risk that happened in that year.
Oh, sorry, that's very open.
Right. Anyone who wants to answer
but
that.
But it would still apply to this.
Mr. Chair.
Chief Cream.
Representatives, I believe that you're referring to the Mille Lacs band.
Right, yes, I am. But would this not actually apply to that, too?
It could, yes.
But that was a problem, seeing what happened. Thank you, Chair. I apologize. Seeing what happened in the community there, this law would apply. So I guess if you could speak to that, because that actually does apply. Maybe it's a different community, but it is still a Native community. This law would apply there, and they experienced a lot of tragedies. So I guess somebody could speak to that.
Mr. Chair, representatives, there was a period of time, as was referenced a little earlier, that the Mille Lacs band was without their law enforcement powers because an agreement like this was rescinded. And during that time, the amount of overdoses that they responded to significantly increased. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it was shocking, the amount of overdoses. They had an infiltration of gang issues because the word on the reservation was that there was no law enforcement, so they could, you know, move in and do whatever they needed to do. I've worked with several of the police officers in the Mille Lacs band, and their hands were essentially tied. They were essentially community service officers within their community, but had no authority to enforce state law within the boundaries of their community. And that's really what we're trying to prevent in the future, is having that ability taken away from us. The local police departments across the state, whether it's a municipal, tribal, or county, they know their constituents, and they know best how to serve their needs. And when that ability is taken away, it can cause harm to the community. And that's really what we're trying to prevent, is that harm.
Representative Edelson.
I apologize about confusing the two tribes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Council. Remind me your last name again, I'm sorry.
Syme.
That's right. Thank you, Ms. Syme. Can you remind me, is there any other country in the world that has this unique juxtaposition of sovereign nations within the boundaries of their sovereign nation? I had heard an anecdote one time that the United States is the only one, but you could probably tell me if that's true or not. And I'm not talking about like South Africa, you know, Swaziland. I'm talking about actually, you know, within the boundaries of the nation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Representative
Lesh.
Sorry, can't see your sign. I'm not aware of any other country or any other place in the world that has the strange legal relationship with the original inhabitants and what we are called domestic dependents and the stratification of federal policy that goes back and forth that creates some of these jurisdictional issues that we have today.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, you know, when I think about this, about when, you know, you discussed PL 280 and what happened prior to that, and I listened intently to our sovereignty day we had in the House chamber too, which was completely interesting. I've always wondered about a lot of that. And I find myself wondering how the founders of this nation and their progeny fancied themselves enlightened. So, whether they were enlightened or not, you know, who knows? But they fancied themselves enlightened. So instead of just going forth and conquering and taking and raping and pillaging, which was the common course of history, they said, well, we're civilized, so we're actually going to create treaties with folks. And didn't follow them, okay? But they still created the treaties because they fancied themselves enlightened folks, not just conquerors. Well, we're still living with the fallout from that, where there are these strange relationships and designations whereby a tribe must rely on a county for its very existence. And that kind of bothers me, and it feels like that's just yet another sort of excuse. It's like we ended slavery but still had Jim Crow. There's this inability to get past certain things, and Ms. Chair, it's just weird. It is weird. It does not make sense to me. And I think because of that, it's time to end. And I think they put forth a good case.
Representative Lesh, I share that sentiment. And it seems to me that at the end of the day, there's a pretty simple proposition here. And that is whether residents at our reservations, American Indian and others, have a right to be safe and have a right to organize themselves in such a way where they can guarantee that safety. It doesn't seem to me too much a stretch of a request as neighbors to be able to count on each other to fulfill that simple but vital function of a civilized society. To Representative Edelson's point, we see where a whole lot of other issues got in the way that made it possible for a lot of unsafety on one of our tribal government lands here. And so I'm really glad you've brought this bill forward, Representative Kodesh-Padin. I think this is a conversation that's long overdue in this state. I think the way that we began this legislative session, by having a conversation with the people on whose land we live, whose homeland we live on, whose homeland that we share love for, and whose home requires us to have mutual obligations to one another. It seems to me this bill is in keeping with that. Representative Kodesh-Padin, I'm going to move forward here because we're a good 45 minutes past our ending time. This debate will continue as we bring this bill forward. I'll have a conversation with you about the pathway of this bill. But at this point, members, the chair lays House File 719 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, the chair brings up from the table House File 2367, which is Representative Dean's bill. And with that before us, Representative Mulder, could you please make the motion for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I don't know what the correct motion is, but I think it's that my ultimate goal is to get it sent to civil law so that we can consider those data privacy issues that were raised.
Indeed, there were privacy issues that were raised in the conversation with the chair. There's a motion to refer House File 2367 over to the Judiciary Civil Law Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We're ready to adjourn. Representative Johnson?
I'm just wondering, since we just have a few minutes, if you could possibly give us an idea of the schedule for next week?
Representative Johnson, we'll post that this evening. I'd be glad to give you a call. Discuss that as well. Members, with that, we stand adjourned. Have a terrific weekend.